Bloom Shapiro, accounting, tax, and business advisors. Asking the questions no one else asks. Creating solutions no one else can. Because achieving your success is how Bloom Shapiro measures theirs. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends, Larry Rifkin and John Kropczyk. And John, 2018 was a watershed year for the Democrats because even against the backdrop of gerrymandering, they were able to accrue, I think it's a 43-seat advantage in the House of Representatives. And they did that with a lot of women running for office for the very first time. And these are not just the people you often hear about, like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, but you're looking at a lot of military veterans, people who actually were more moderate. They came from places far and wide, and they represent the largest class of women in the House of Representatives, and many of them have really great political futures ahead of them.
Oh, yeah, there's a few that I would think about for president, and I think this is a long time coming, and it's about time that they really broke up the boys club in Washington and, got the women's voices in there.
I got to tell you, John, you know what's really fascinating when you have that conversation? There are many things that have to change, even within the confines of the U.S. Capitol, because you generally ascribe to the notion that this is a man's place. And women will say, well, wait a minute, why is it that our bathrooms are so many fewer? Or why is it that you actually don't have an area for women to change? Or whatever it may be, They just never took those things into account.
No, they didn't. But you know what? It's good that they finally have, and that they're women are there, and, they're going to stay there. And who knows? They may overtake the men in Washington.
Well, you know what's fascinating, John? I've been watching a lot more news during the pandemic, and I don't know if it's just me, but I'm seeing women who are running major cities across the country. I never knew who they were before. They're really impressive. The mayor of Atlanta has really impressed me. The mayor of Tucson, Arizona. Really thoughtful people. And then you see the rich diversity. Not only many women and women who are of various backgrounds and political stripes, but you also see many men who might be Latino or Cuban or whatever they may be running major swaths of municipalities and counties across the country. I think it's great.
No, I think it's great too. I think we have one of the most diverse political party, system that we've ever had. I mean, it's really impressive.
And they're very diverse, John. Yes. They're not all very liberal like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. I mean, there is that contingent, but there are more moderate members who come out of the military. It's a group you cannot just put your finger and say, oh, well, that's the group who came in 2018.
Right.
In fact, if you recall, it was that piece in the Washington Post where it was from the moderates, those who were in these purple districts where Donald Trump may have won, but these women ran as moderate Democrats and they won back these seats. They were the ones who wrote that editorial saying, we really need to begin impeachment. They felt that they had seen something that was so egregious to them. And that really convinced Nancy Pelosi. She was not going to go forward, as you recall, with impeachment until these women, the more moderates, came forward. But it's fascinating. Who are these women? And how do they have, really, in some cases, the temerity to run for these powerful offices and unseat these long-term incumbents? And sometimes, John, within their own party, they had to get through an incumbent and then go on. Sometimes they didn't have to primary to get to where they are. But just to run a political campaign, John, as the candidate, is really a major undertaking.
Well, I think we need to get a lot of those people who have been in office too long out of there. I think, unfortunately, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And I think we see that in Congress and Senate, and we really need to vote these people out.
Well, one of the questions that I have for Jennifer Steinhauer is, are these people in it for the long term, or are they just saying, look, I wanted to make my case. I want to come here and do the right things as I see it, and I don't care about re-election.
That's what it should be about.
Well,
that's what
don't forget, they're only in their first term, John. They may not have gotten enough of a taste of the delicacy of American power. Well, we're going to find out a lot more about them today on this podcast. The book is called The First, The Inside Story of the Women Reshaping Congress, today on America Trends.
When the history books are written on the 2018 congressional campaign, many are going to focus on the amazing blue wave that swept Democrats into the House majority, even as the 2010 gerrymandering by the GOP was meant to blunt that for at least a decade. The other headline will be the class of women who crashed through many barriers to become first-term congresswomen. And the book that really defines that movement was written by Jennifer Steinhauer. It's called The First, The Inside Story of the Women Reshaping Congress. What a remarkable story, Jennifer, you've had to lay out for us. As you look at it in hindsight, how remarkable is this team or this group of very diverse women?
I mean, first of all, we would be remiss in not noting that being even a tiny bit below 25% of Congress made up of women is still relatively low, but at the same time, it is a record. This particular group of women, it's a very interesting group because it's such a diverse group, whether it's people who are the first Muslim women in Congress, the first Native American women, the first women and minorities from their districts, the list goes on and on, the youngest, the oldest female to serve in the House. But at the same time, you know, they come from these very different, yes, racial and ethnic backgrounds, geographic areas, and professional backgrounds. So it's just, you're seeing a huge breadth of life experiences in this class.
The class of women we're talking about not only took out GOP incumbents, but within their own party, they took out white male incumbents in many cases.
Yes, those were, I would say, the more high-profile cases. I would say the majority of cases were actually the first thing you mentioned, beating Republicans, because that's, of course, how Democrats were able to take back the House. You have to beat the Republicans, and a lot of women did do that in districts that lean more Republican or in some cases were, you know, a lot more Republican. But you're absolutely right. Some of the more high-profile women, in particular AOC, took out a very senior incumbent, someone, Joe Crowley, who people thought in New York City would eventually perhaps be the Speaker of the House. So in those cases, sometimes not even so much of an ideological difference as you do just seeing something sort of generational and different types of leadership that's being represented and that voters are choosing in those districts, as more liberal districts.
Jennifer, it might be hard for people to recall this, but it wasn't so long ago that most women who had ascended to a seat in Congress, that they were picking up the legacy and the mantle of their deceased husbands. When did that really begin to change?
That itself continued on for quite a while, even when it did begin to shift in the 60s and 70s, particularly obviously against the backdrop of both the women's movement and resistance to the Vietnam War, which was bringing in all different kinds of people running for office anyway. But that was fueled, as was with all women entering the workplace, women running on their own, choosing to run, not just filling the seat of their dead husband. And those are the women who really interestingly faced, I would say, the first real wave of resistance and pretty abject sexism, both back home in their districts and once they got to Washington, a kind of a who do you think you are type thing, and especially those who had pretty aggressive policy agendas.
When we go back to other wave elections, we're looking at 1974 after Watergate, the Watergate babies, and then 1992 in response to Clarence Thomas hearings. Put this into context, is this really a response to the legacy of Donald Trump's presidency?
Short answer is yes. I look at it as a bit more of a trajectory in the contemporary era, which is to say I kind of think of the beginning of this movement as starting in 2010 when you had the big Tea Party wave. And that was a real change for politics, especially within the Republican Party. Obviously, 87 freshmen came in 2011, and that's when the House flipped back to Republicans. And that was a really different kind of Republican that came out of the Tea Party wave, people who, again, in reverse, won in Democratic districts and so forth, and really came to shake up Washington within their own party. And that movement sort of morphed into what we saw in 2016 when Donald Trump and his brand of sort of a populist switch on that, if you will, infiltrated and eventually, I think it's hard to dispute, really took over the Republican Party. So the Republican Party is now firmly really the party of Trump. And we see this in 2016. 2018 midterm elections was the response to that, and I would argue sort of the bookend to that whole decade of sea change, where you have a lot of women running directly in response to Trump and in response to a disenchantment among female voters, a lot of them in Republican districts, looking for different kinds of leadership, being open to women, being open to Democrats, and sort of being the capstone to that period, I would say. And so the same question you would pose of them and pose of the class that came in after Watergate that you alluded to, will they change Washington or Washington change them? And that's kind of the process we're watching unfold.
Now, this class didn't seem to wait their turn necessarily. They became consequential. They became present. They got really involved in many debates and have been very active on many committees. And that's not just them per se. I mean, that's in part some of the responsibilities that they were given by another woman, that being Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House.
Yeah, I mean, Nancy Pelosi stays powerful and, in fact, you know, was able to become Speaker for a second time, which, as you may recall at the time, was by no means a fait accompli, because she is able to look at the totality and the breadth of her caucus and think, what did individual people want and need to be supportive of me and to be supportive of legislation that I need to get over the line and so forth. She's much more clever at that than John Boehner or Paul Ryan, her two most immediate predecessors were, with their own complicated conference. And part of that was recognizing how large this freshman class was, how consequential, and I think also how qualified, because they, again, came from these really diverse professional backgrounds and had run on healthcare a lot, too. So they were in that particular policy area. She was letting them take on bills and so forth and become subcommittee chairwomen and men, chairwomen of important committees, which, you know, to your average citizen, it's like, oh, well, how big a deal is that? Well, it's a big deal. It's not something freshmen usually do, and it gives you a certain amount of power to shape legislation and shape an agenda, at least in the House. Now, when it gets to the Senate, you know, that's a different story because they obviously have rejected and ignored a lot of legislation that happens in the divided government that's coming from the Democratic-controlled House. But within the Democratic-controlled House, within that caucus, you do see these freshman women with a lot more power, and as you point out, a lot more vocal. You know, usually you kind of keep your head down as a freshman, don't get much attention. Some of them had already been in national media before they even were sworn in, right? So they kind of felt like they had the ability to leverage that political power out in the world and try to use that as legislative power and power within their own caucus once they got to Capitol Hill. I would add with mixed results, but that was their mindset, and Nancy Pelosi did realize that, not always to her pleasure, but she certainly saw it and understood it.
Yeah, and we shouldn't underestimate the fact that there were many forces going on, many who were challenging her, at least thinking about challenging her for the speakership. And yet these women coming in, they represented not only diverse ages and ethnicity, but political ideology. You've got the National Security Group. You've got the more progressive group. I mean, how did she make certain to get their support in some totality for her renewed speakership?
It really was an amazing thing to watch, because you had some of the women and men, by the way, in the more conservative areas vow to their constituents who didn't necessarily have a very nice opinion of Nancy Pelosi that they weren't going to vote for her for speaker. And by the way, a few of them in the end didn't. You had just as many. We forget this now, and they kind of try to wash over this, but it's absolutely what happened. You also had a lot of the progressives saying that from a completely different vantage point. that it was time for new blood, and they were the new face of the party, and the party needed to move to the left, and they needed a much more progressive and younger and fresher face in the speaker chair. And slowly, one by one, she was managed to change their minds. I think made them understand and believe that she would be supportive of them, and that she would be a more effective speaker facing off with Mitch McConnell in the Senate and Donald Trump in the White House than somebody new. Bit by bit, member by member, which is her style, she was able to return most of them to her. And even some of the more senior members, she was able to hear what they wanted and talk about things that they might be able to get down the line as a result of supporting her. So it's carrots and sticks with Nancy Pelosi, for sure, but she's good with her carrots. And in the end, there were very few Democrats. Some did, for sure. And that was okay, I think, as long as they weren't super ostentatious about it. You know, the speaker understood that for their district, they may need to vote against her. As long as she was going to get over the line, that was okay. And a handful certainly did. She pulled it off.
For those who might see Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez as the star of this class, and now, of course, being thrust into the role, perhaps, as the leader of the progressive movement, as Bernie Sanders has dropped out of the presidential race, is that an overstatement?
I don't think it is. I mean, of course, time will tell, and we still have Elizabeth Warren with us. But Elizabeth Warren, I think we can't be sure that her political ambitions beyond the Senate will ever be reignited. And even if they are, I just think that AOC, given her age, given the following of millennial voters for her, which obviously is a huge chunk of, you know, our population, and we'll remain to be seen what Generation Z does. You know, she's got that appeal, and she just seems to be a face that everybody kind of associates with the progressive left. Whereas Elizabeth Warren, it's not that they don't, but I think it's been a more shifting view, if you will. AOC is probably equally polarizing character in American life. I mean, she certainly has become the face of the party for Republicans who want to demonize her. She's kind of replaced Nancy Pelosi in that role, I thought, really interestingly, and it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out as we get closer and closer to the 2020 elections. She's really perhaps much more powerful in the political arena in her party than she has been so far in the policy arena on Capitol Hill. Because remember, all the ideas that she's talking about haven't come even close to passing in the House.
We'll be back with more of this America Trends podcast in 30 seconds. Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, delivers over 40 years of experience in a broad base of services from accounting and tax to cybersecurity, technology, and transaction advisory. Bloom's experts will maintain an unwavering focus on your future so you can focus on what's most important to you. Your business. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
Jennifer Steinhauer is with us. The book is called The First, The Inside Story of the Women Reshaping Congress. And it's interesting, we pay a lot of attention to this squad, in part because the president took them on and they responded to him. But it was really the national security first-time women in purple districts whose op-ed piece in the Washington Post moved the impeachment process forward. Is there a schism there, or is too much made of that? How do they all work together? I think in your book you point to the fact that the National Security Group actually works more collaboratively, perhaps, than the squad.
I think that they're more of a squad than the squad, which is to say, first of all, you know, they really all got to know each other during the 2018 election season. Partly because they were enjoying the backing of a group called Vote Vets, which has become an increasingly powerful group that raises money and helps, promulgate the policies and candidates from the military background on the Democratic side of the aisle. And so they campaigned together a lot. They helped each other. They talked a lot. So, and there were some men in this group, too, I might add. And when they got to the Hill, they had much more actually predetermined relationships. Pre-established relationships, the members of the squad, most of whom didn't really know each other and had barely interacted really before they got to Washington. So there was that. What I really noticed is that when it came to matters of policy, the squad, meaning AOC, Ayanna Pressley, Rashida Tlaib, Ilhan Omar, they often did vote together, and they often would, you know, do press conferences together, and but they really kind of went their own way. They both had their own sort of national profiles. They had different kinds of districts. They had a little bit different type of social media strategy. And they didn't, you know, Ayanna Pressley, for example, was Elizabeth Warren supporter. She didn't go on for Bernie the way the other three did. So they voted differently than you might expect if you were to parse their voting records. You see, a lot of times they were not always in sync. The national security folks, and I'm talking there, we should familiarize your listeners with who that is. You know, Abigail Spanberger and Elaine Luria from Virginia, for example, Mikey Sherrill from New Jersey, Chrissy Houlihan from Pennsylvania, Alyssa Slotkin, she's from Central Michigan. She's emerged as a pretty important figure, served in CIA, DOD capacities under Bush and Obama, pretty Republican district. All of them beat Republicans in their in 2018, and obviously to varying degrees will have tough races going forward as well. They tended to kind of work together more. They had this group text, and they were always checking with each other on legislation, as you point out, with some men came together to write that pretty seminal op-ed for the Washington Post advocating moving forward the peace process, specifically as it stemmed from the Ukraine matter. Because a lot of the liberals, you know, from day one, literally, starting with Rashida Tlaib on the night that they were all sworn in, was talking about impeaching the president. That was not popular in Republican districts, and that was not an interest of these women and any of the moderates, really, who won those districts. And that was kind of changed only at that point when that op-ed came out. And history will show whether that was a wise move to push that or not. And it's probably not something I would think any in those districts are going to run on. They've got other issues and other local things that they'll focus on. And, of course, the COVID-19 reshapes the entire election process. But to your question about the conflict, yes. Was there a conflict? Yes. Did they fight over bills and moving them too far to the left or too far to the center? Yes. Did the left wing end get angry when some of those colleagues were more moderate even side of Republicans? Absolutely. And even AOC kind of threatened them with primary challenges, which became, you know, very controversial and caused some hard feelings in that group. So not just national security women, but all, I'd say, moderate women and some men, or not even necessarily so moderate, but just not part of the so-called Justice Democrats. I shouldn't say so-called. Justice Democrats is a movement that created AOC. So that conflict really did, I think, presage what you saw happen on the Democratic stage between Bernie Sanders and the more moderate candidates as you went through the primary season.
When I look back here in my state of Connecticut, where we elected the first woman on her own as governor, but she was seen by a political boss, John Bailey at the time, as being somebody who had that ability. She could really attract both men and women. And yet I live adjacent to the district where Johanna Hayes won. Now, Johanna Hayes did have the support of Senator Chris Murphy in a primary battle against a more experienced woman who was not the incumbent in that district. But I'm just wondering what propelled, aside from Donald Trump, all of these women to decide, and they come from very different backgrounds. You talk about the Muslim and Native American women in this group, totally apart from many of the other experiences of, say, the National Security Group. I mean, what was it that lit the spark? Because women have been reticent in many cases to run for office. I know I interviewed a woman who heads the Yale School helping women to prepare for elective office. And I remember her saying that women don't like at times the hubris of it all, the ego involved, and they don't like the fundraising aspect either.
Yeah, I mean, historically, the case has been that women have to be asked to run multiple times. Whereas men will look in the mirror and say, hey, I should run. You know, it's not a convincing process most of the time. I think women have gotten better about that. Fundraising, too, they've gotten more comfortable with that. But it's definitely still true that women need more convincing, and they need a financial apparatus, which is one reason Democrats, there are many reasons, but one reason Democrats in recent years have been more successful than Republican women is because they have Emily's List, which is a very specific group. It targets and supports pro-choice Democrats, which is kind of all you have left federally in the party. That's been a huge, kind of underappreciated dynamic, by the way, I think, is that you can't really win a primary anymore as a Democrat in the House if you're not pro-choice, and you can't really do it if you're a Republican if you're not pro-life. There used to be a lot more elasticity in both parties on that. that's been one of the most important political and policy, political sea changes, I think, that's impacted the process and the makeup of the House in the last, over the last decade, maybe even the last 5 years, certainly over the last decade. But you, I want to, address what you said about Johanna Hayes, because she's an example of the question you're asking about what inspires women to run. You know, Chris Murphy, this is detailed a lot in my book, that particular race, where Senator Chris Murphy had seen her around. She won Teacher of the Year, as you remember. She was honored by Obama. And
yeah, the National Teacher of the Year Award.
Yes, exactly. So she was not so obscure, you know. I mean, certainly she was not a household name, and she was, as you point out, not as well known as the woman that she ran against, who was, that was for an open seat. And it was definitely uphill for Johanna Hayes, and she didn't want to do it, and she resisted Chris Murphy's recruitment, per what we were just talking about with women, several times. And what she told me, and what she's talked about a lot subsequently, is that, you know, she did, what made her special, and I think, you know, obviously helped fuel that award and her attention, is that she spent a lot of time outside the classroom with her kids, really trying to give them an orientation towards service, working with Habitat for Humanity, building homes, helping sometimes these kids from pretty rough economic circumstances themselves. So she was always trying to teach to help kids who were even worse situations, or families that were in worse situations, homes destroyed and so forth. And she said she had taken them on a field trip to rebuild homes, and I think she was kind of hammering nails, and she thought, gosh, I'm asking these kids to do something, and I'm not stepping up myself. So, gosh, I'm going to run after all. And I think she made the filing date, you know, in the very last minute, and had a lot of complications. You know, you're in Connecticut. That was kind of a hairy situation with the primary there, and it was a lot of back and forth, and it really looked like she might was the underdog there, but she prevailed. And she's important for a lot of reasons, for the type of diversity that comes from the House. You know, she's a teenage mother. I think she was, remember, she spent some time, you know, in pretty abject.
Yes, absolutely. In the city of Waterbury, yes.
Yes, in Waterbury. She's very, you know, proud of that, of her, where she comes from. So she represents the diversity of these women economically, racially, but also she represents something you alluded to earlier, is that when you get to Congress and you've won, in spite of your background being so different from the typical person who wins for Congress, and you win in a tough race, you get to Washington and you think, hey, my race is a lot tougher than a lot of people. I deserve a stronger voice than maybe your typical freshman, right? Because I've done things my way, and I've proven that I'm successful, and I would like to be impactful in the discussions here as well.
Well, what about political power in the House? You remind us that now there are 25% women in the House, primarily Democratic. They might inspire a lot of Republican women to run in 2020, given that there are many Republican incumbents who are leaving their posts. But who's still in charge? I mean, because when we saw that stark metaphor for the different parties, with all the diversity on the Democratic side, and during some of the hearings that went very public, we see white men on the GOP side. So where is the power? We have a speaker who's a woman. Is it still a power differential, the 75-25? Is that still representative? Or are women gaining perhaps inordinate power and authority going forward?
Well, definitely the reason that you had the Women's Caucus in the very beginning, women started to really increase in numbers, is because they did not have committee assignments and so forth. Certainly they didn't have committee gavels, and that was necessary for them to be able kind of to promote some of their agenda. Now, when the Democrats controlled the Senate, they had a lot of women who had gavels, and women were really gaining power, even though they weren't gaining in numbers so much, still lingering around 25%. They were really having a lot more power than you'd seen women have ever in the history of the Senate. And that's happened somewhat with Democrats now too. But to your point, it's still a male-dominated institution, and more men are still in the biggest roles of power. And, you know, I had a pretty senior woman who I was talking to once in her office for my book, who said, you know, celebrated all these women coming here, and we still do it publicly, but behind the scenes, a lot of the men start grumbling, you know, oh, we're hearing too much about these women. Sometimes it was specifically to the freshmen, but they wanted to celebrate them. They're Democrats, and they wanted to note all these women who'd come in, but they didn't necessarily want to give up their power to them. And that's sort of a little underappreciated thing that's going on there.
And they even changed a lot about the mores in terms of where women could go, the bathrooms, the gym, the whole range of amenities that go along with this. What about the notion that this is all taking place, this wave of new women, congresswomen, in this backdrop of the Me Too movement? And some might wonder whether their focus is on what have typically been called women's issues, pay equity, family leave, daycare, or is the interest of this class much broader than that?
Oh, well, it is much broader than that. I mean, the Me Too movement came to Congress in an important way because it really forced them to codify things that we think are common sense about what rules are. And I think, again, from what I heard from women, this was a huge issue at orientation. Some people thought they talked about it almost too much and not teaching them how to, you know, kind of like just be members of Congress. I mean, it was a real obsession, these new rules that got codified in the 116th Congress about that. And a lot of the men were pretty nervous about it. But then what's really interesting, I think, and very telling and very nuanced is the first person to really get in big trouble when those were passed was a female freshman who was actually in a position of power representing the freshman class. And I'm speaking obviously of Katie Hill from Southern California, who got caught in a bit of a sex scandal and was also charged with having an inappropriate relationship with a member of her staff and ended up resigning from Congress before the first year was even up. So the Me Too, the biggest Me Too issue that came up in that Congress was a female freshman. So you kind of see the different ways that this cuts. But in terms of what we call women's issues, and I would say more family issues or American family issues, yes, they were able to help fuel that and to get a paid family leave for certain civilian employees in the Department, the Defense Act recently. That was bipartisan. But I think their interests are very, very diverse. I mean, if you look at these women from national security backgrounds, they're in with their sleeves rolled up on some of the most intense, significant, and complicated national security issues. Healthcare was what most of these women ran on, and they continue with varying degrees to be very interested in that. Again, the COVID-19 situation puts more emphasis on that. At the time, in 2018, it was about the Affordable Care Act. Now it's a lot more about drug pricing. But I would say yes, their interests are wide and varied, and they overlap with obviously a lot of the men, and I think that's just going to be increasingly the case.
Now, I know Senator Patty Murray in 1992 helped to frame a process of debate that personalized issues, and I think she was criticized about that by some of the men. We don't like to do that. We like to objectify issues, and yet these women have been very personal, telling their personal stories in certain cases like Katie Porter as a single mom and also a victim of domestic abuse. So are they changing the way that debate occurs in Congress?
Well, first of all, I have to say you obviously have carefully read the book. So thank you for that. You really know these women's stories very well. I think, look, what I would say is that there's been a real emphasis in the last few years in American politics on what we refer to, you know, as authenticity. And I think that women have been feeling a lot more comfortable with not trying to hide, but in fact emphasize their personal circumstances, their motherhood in some cases, their single motherhood, times where, you know, people might have tried to hide their poverty, background, difficult circumstances. Now they talk about that very openly to identify with some of the people that may be supporting them. So I think that all these kind of things, you know, if you look back, there's an anecdote in the book about one of the earlier women of Congress. You know, we have it's a very formal debate process, and they'll say, you know, the gentle lady, you know, from Arkansas or whatever, they speak, and she said, I'm a congressman, and you will address me that way. You know, there's maybe an idea that all the women who ran for Congress in the history of our country were all feminists, and that's definitely not the case, and it wasn't definitely not always the case early on, even though the first woman to run and win, Jeanette Rankin, before we even nationally had the right to vote, you know, she was a suffragist. That was her agenda. But that wasn't the agenda of all women, I think, and it's not the agenda now. But they definitely, on both sides of the aisle, I would say, are much more open and even celebratory of their lives as women, as mothers, and that's very much just part of our political culture now.
And when we look at these women, do you see them being more interested in incumbency, or are they more interested by saying, I didn't expect to win in the first place, so if I don't make it back, I'm going to make my bones right now, and I'm going to be as vocal about what I care about? Do you see that? Because we see congresswomen and men falling into the trap of wanting the perks of the office to remain part of their existence for as long as they can.
Most people who run for office, even when they say otherwise, don't really want to leave office once they get there for a variety of reasons. But I think what I would say is that a lot of the women, and part of men, who won in really difficult districts and have a self-awareness to understand that they may not be back after 2 years, really did want to make those 2 years matter. In fact, Charisse Davids, one of the first Native American women who comes from Kansas City, Kansas area, was pretty clear and vocal about that in one of the meetings of the Democratic caucus early on, that she wants to have her impact. And I think that's, interestingly enough, a bit more rare for people to express that. But I definitely think it's in the back of the minds with the people who come from challenging districts.
In closing, political advancement, Ayanna Pressley, she is very impressive as a speaker. Elizabeth Slatkin, you mentioned, Lauren Underwood, Mikey Sherrill. Are these some of the real first-timers who are very impressive at the outset?
I think there's a lot of them. And, you know, it's, I was amazed that I covered a freshman class of 2011, as I said, Republicans who helped, you know, took over the House that year. And I was amazed 5, 6, 7 years later to look down on the Senate floor and see a few of them as senators for a variety of reasons, of seats that opened and government, you know, governor appointments and things. But this, their, the speed of which they moved through the system was really something. And I would expect to see some of that with some of these women as well. I wouldn't be surprised at all.
Jennifer Steinhauer, thank you so much for being with us on America Trends. This is clearly a trend that is very significant in our politics. The book is called The Firsts, The Inside Story of the Women Reshaping Congress. Jennifer, thanks again.
Thanks for your time. I appreciate your interest.
America Trends podcast is part of the MHNR Network, mhnrnetwork.com. At Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, discovering what makes you different is what makes Bloom different.